Hi, it's Karen Webster for Payments.com, and I'm here today with David Luther, CMO and Executive Vice President for Mozito. David, thanks for joining me today.
Yes, Karen, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
So we're here to get a little bit of your insight about some of the things we observed in the most recent issue of the Financial Inclusion Tracker. And there are a couple of topics of conversation that I'd like to explore. The first is an interesting take that the Omidar Network has on investing in the area of financial inclusion and where they see the greatest opportunity to put capital at work for those that are trying to solve the problem. And they take kind of a dual approach, which I found interesting. They invest in advocacy to try to gather momentum around policy changes and things that really need to, in many cases, move things forward. And then they obviously invest in innovators that are trying to solve the problem. A lot of those investments, though, are in infrastructure. So kind of core aspects of problems in country that almost have to be put in place before some of the applications that I think we all tend to focus on can actually be deployed. What's your thought on that approach, and what is Mozito doing? Because I know you invest a lot of capital in this area as well.
Well, I haven't seen that unique approach. I've more seen it done as two separate tracks. And so, you know, we followed some of what the Gates Foundation and World Bank is doing around that first track, more around how they can affect positive regulation for financial inclusion, how they can do surveys on what's actually working in financial inclusion and how it could be replicated other places in the world. So I think, you know, that's the same first track that you discussed. And the second track is more what we focus on, which is how can we follow that investment in regulatory improvement, in figuring out what really can be replicated that's working. How can we put that into practice with commercial engagement that has more mass adoption? So I hadn't seen a company doing both. I think it makes a lot of sense if you have the financial model to do that, because they can kind of have the commercial companies follow what they're doing on the regulatory and inclusion track.
Yeah, it is interesting because, you know, advocacy is important to perhaps persuading the regulators and the bankers and the different players in country to adopt common principles and to be like-minded in moving things forward. But it can be a very long and tedious investment. And I think putting money to work in the hands of innovators is always more interesting.
Karen, we've kind of done that more directly in terms of the central banks, but it takes a lot of time, as you said. So in Jamaica, it took us 2 years working with the central bank to get regulatory approval to do mobile payments and mobile financial services. In 16.
Wow.
16 people applied. We were the only ones that got it. So you have to work very closely with them and basically help them write some of the regulations sometimes.
Well, yeah. And I think it also helps if you're able to put in front of those regulators instances where things are working, because I think then there's a little bit more of an incentive on their part to shift their thinking, as I know you've done. Let's talk a little bit about country focus. And we've talked about this before. I know that Mozito is very focused in Africa, has made an acquisition there that is moving the mobile money agenda forward in country there. But a lot of the emphasis is moving to India, and in particular because of some of the regulatory relaxation that is happening there with the payment licenses that are being distributed. Is that why you think India has become such a hotbed for financial inclusion activities?
Well, I think India has a confluence of events that make it ripe for financial inclusion. One of them that you mentioned, that the political and regulatory climate is actually promoting financial inclusion and actually putting in new regulations that allow things like the payments bank, which will allow merchant locations to be cash in, cash out locations, essentially mini bank branches. So that's the starting point. I mean, if you don't have that, you probably are not going to be successful in mass adoption of mobile banking and mobile payments. But that's only one of the factors. So the other is, of course, that they have a large adoption of mobile phones moving to smartphones. So people have the means now, the channel to access these financial services through the mobile. And the last is the investment in that market in general. So again, the government has made it a very pleasant climate for outsiders now to come and invest into India. And so you're seeing large investments into the country, many of which are being applied to mobile and some of which are being applied to financial inclusion. So we've been working on a number of initiatives in India. We'll hopefully be able to announce one soon that will be targeted at mass adoption of not only financial services, but lifestyle services that they can use from the same application. Because we actually believe that you need an application that people are using every day to get traction. So it may be for other things like buying movie tickets and paying for transportation tickets and things, not just financial inclusion.
Interesting. Well, we'll be anxious to hear more about that when the time is right. You made a point about the availability of phones, obviously, and the increasing availability of smartphones as a real driver for these initiatives. And mobile banking certainly is one of those activities that is now more widely available because of mobile phones. And adoption is really on the rise. And I found this statistic both encouraging and surprising. 25% of the world's population over the next 4 years will in fact adopt mobile banking services. That's a lot of people. Your thoughts on, first of all, do you think that's a real possibility? And if so, doesn't that suggest that that's a pretty critical mass of people to move the financial inclusion agenda forward?
Well, first, yes, I think it is possible. I think it will happen only with some changes in the environment and the climate that we just spoke about. So, you know, I've seen some stats that said, hey, the 2.5 billion people in the world that were unbanked is now down to 2 billion. But I don't really think those are true, meaningful statistics, because a lot of what happened initially in India, for instance, is there was a big movement to actually provide bank accounts to a lot of unbanked people. But if you look at them, most of them have no balances, and most of the branches are miles away from the people that need them. So that they're essentially not being used. They got people to sign up for something that isn't very useful to them. So it needs that network. And I know the article this month talked about a network in Indonesia, but it needs the same kind of network in India of locations out to the many rural areas and in Indonesia, the many islands that they have, of an interoperable service that people can access for, they still need cash in, cash out, perhaps places to pick up items that they order. So as it moves to mobile, you still need this physical location, at least in the interim, as some of the business will be through cash. But yeah, I think it's very probable that mobile is reached a tipping point and that it will reach at least 25%, if not more, in the next 4 years.
So, David, I always love getting an update on what Mozito is doing. I know that the ecosystem that you have created and are continuing to add to around the world to address this particular opportunity is vast. So tell us, what are you seeing? What are you working on? What kinds of things do you think we should be paying attention to?
Sure, Karen. So one of the things that we're just trying to do is get more mass adoption of payments through mobile. And that may take a different form in different markets. So we might find a single pain point to address in a market and then add additional services so we can grow the services, but initially we solve a problem. So in Africa, initially in the first country we went into, which is Zimbabwe, they had moved from postpaid electricity to prepaid. And literally the people would have to go to a physical location with cash to buy more electricity and get a four-digit code and go back to their home to get more electricity turned on. So just by mobilizing that and allowing them to put some money on a mobile account, if you will, not a true bank account, and then use it for initially topping up electricity and getting the four-digit code texted to them or sent via smartphone to them if they have one, so that they could immediately turn on their electricity and get more, that solved the real pain point. And then we're able to branch out into person-to-person payments, other utility payments, person-to-merchant payments, and so on. So, you know, that's the way that we're entering Africa, and we've got a kind of 10-country plan to expand there. In China, it's something different. We acquired PayEase, and they had a real problem of Chinese citizens not being able to buy goods outside of China. So we bought PayEase, which allowed cross-border payments so that Chinese citizens could shop on either a browser on their computer, but more and more often on a mobile phone, and they could buy Apple goods, Nike, and so on. There are about 1,500 brands now that we facilitate the payment for those brands to Chinese citizens. That will expand to additional services for those consumers, where we'll start to add, as I said, person-to-person payments, bill payments, ticketing for transportation, and things like that. So we go in trying to solve an initial pain point and then expand what we're doing. In that case in China, just last month, we announced an initiative to allow something called TradeEase, which is China citizens to buy goods from Russia and Russian citizens to buy goods from China. In fact, that was such a big deal that the government issued a commemorative postage stamp around TradeEase being the first cross-border electronic commerce between Russia and China.
Really? That's impressive.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun to be part of those things, of course. And the world is getting flatter, and commerce is getting flatter, I think, and easier to do. And the mobile phones are enabling that. One more example in India is, and I think you alluded to this in the tracker this month, people without credit cards and bank accounts in India, they can't buy anything from commerce sites. So just allowing them to put some money on a mobile account and then participate in some of the popular commerce sites that are like Flipkart opens up a vast amount of e-commerce opportunities to the citizens that don't have bank and credit cards, and also to the merchants that want to capture those sales.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think the point that you made is that is a simple point, but often one that is overlooked. Find the pain, solve for that, and use that as your hook into a market and build from that. I mean, solving the pain point obviously creates a trigger for adoption, and it's much easier to layer services on top of that once you've satisfied a real area of need. That's a smart way to do it.
Yeah, thanks, Karen. It seems to be working for us. And if you start with a pain point, it's also sticky too. So, you know, we're not going into markets and giving away a dollar for doing something on our mobile app. We're trying not to do things that way because people move from one mobile app to another just to get the promotion. And we try to make it something that's valuable to them without having to compensate them monetarily. And I think in the long run, that's the right way to do it.
Well, it's always great, David, to get your perspective on what's going on in the world of financial inclusion, and in particular, how mobile is reshaping that landscape. Thanks for taking the time to talk with me today.
Thank you, Karen.